Interview with Roberta Carmel, November 18th, 2005, at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr.
Well, I want to start out with some of your early educational experiences, your undergrad and law school, and take us to where you...
Oh, that's going way back.
It is indeed.
Okay, well, I was born in Chicago, Illinois, and I went to a public grade school and high school, Austin High School. I recently had occasion to read an article about Austin High School that was in 17 magazine in the 50s, and they made it sound like an ideal Midwestern experience. This article also said it was the largest coeducational public high school in the Midwest. It was enormous, 4,500 students. I thought it was not a very good high school, and I didn't feel I learned very much there. I was quite frustrated in my high school experiences. Fortunately, some of the teachers at the high school noticed me and told my mother that I ought to apply to some school other than the University of Illinois. The high school I went to, only about half of the graduates went to college. If you get this coughing in, don't type it up.
Yeah.
And of the graduates who went to college, there was one question they asked each other: are you going downstate or to Navy Pier? And I was one of three from my graduating class who took what were then the college boards. I had to travel all the way to some Northwestern building, not in Evanston, but on the near north side. I was afraid I would never find the building. I was much more worried about that than the test. And I was advised to apply to several different schools. I was interested in writing. I thought I would become a writer. And one of them was Radcliffe, although my first reaction was that I did not want to go to a girls' school. And I was told, oh, don't worry, it's part of Harvard. It's not really a girls' school. And I was fortunately admitted. I never quite understood how. I thought this was some mistake in the admissions office that I went to Radcliffe. So I spent my undergraduate days at Radcliffe, and I think it really was an experience that changed my life. It opened a lot of doors for me. And I also met my late husband while I was an undergraduate. I was married after my sophomore year, but I did finish college. And then after college, I wanted to do something. I found out that it wasn't very easy, even with my fancy Radcliffe degree, to get a job in Boston in the late 50s, although I did work for 6 months for a brokerage firm. I worked in the, well, what I guess you would say was the back office, but I really worked in the trading room. I had a Frieden calculating machine, and I computed the traders' positions to tell them if they were going over their position limits and whether they could buy or sell securities. I also answered the teletype machines when they rang, and I was theoretically an assistant to the security analyst. And he did take me to a few annual meetings and have me write reports up afterwards.
Was this just happenstance that took you into this?
Well, yes and no. I graduated from college in February. I accelerated my graduation by a semester. I graduated in February, and I went around looking for a job, and there were not a lot of jobs around. There were a lot of Harvard and Radcliffe graduates in the market. And my father, who was a lawyer, but he had always been interested in the stock market, and he used to talk to me a lot about stocks. So I thought, well, I'll just walk around to brokerage firms, investment, and apply for jobs. So it wasn't total happenstance, but there was a job available. I made $40 a week cash that I was paid every Friday. I thought that was fantastic. I didn't realize then that the reason brokerage firms paid in cash is that sometimes they would tell an employee on a Friday, here's your last paycheck, you're fired.
So did you make the decision then to go?
Right, then I decided I wanted to work for a little bit after college before starting a family. I felt I wasn't quite ready for a family yet. And my husband also wanted to go back to school. So we applied to a variety of schools. I took the LSATs. It was a little unusual for a woman to do that, but going to a professional school was something that the deans at Radcliffe somewhat encouraged. I remember going in to see one of the Radcliffe deans after I took the LSATs and saying I was a little worried because a lot of the men I'd taken the exam with had gotten much better scores than I did. And she looked at the scores and she said, oh, you'll get into Harvard, it's okay. I said, well, what if I want to go to a school other than Harvard Law School? I can't get anywhere else. I was so naive. I really was. And the reason that she had said with great confidence, you'll get into Harvard, is at that time, Harvard Law School had a quota of 10% women that they allowed in. But they never got enough applications to fill their quota. So it was a kind of a strange situation. And if you were a Radcliffe graduate and your grades were good, you automatically were admitted to Harvard Law School. So, but then I got a full scholarship to NYU, so I went to NYU instead of Harvard, Harvard Law School considered I was still the responsibility of my father, even though I was married, but I didn't see it that way, and neither did my father. I really didn't have the money to go to law school, so I went to NYU because I got a scholarship, and also my husband got a better financial deal at Columbia than some of the other schools that he had applied to. So we moved to New York. He was a New Yorker anyway, and he was one of these New Yorkers who thought any place outside of Manhattan was not a good place to live.
Yeah. Did you decide to go into securities law right off the bat?
No, I didn't. Actually, I did very well in law school, and I thought I might go to a Wall Street law firm, but they were pretty much not hiring women in those days. I remember going to one interview, actually. I had one of the few firms that gave me, I think the only firm that gave me a callback, and it was a very posh Wall Street law firm, and the man who took me around said to me, about a half an hour into the callback process, you know, we've already hired a woman, so I don't think you have much chance of a job offer. My husband said that was the interview where he met me afterwards, and I was sitting, I don't know, on a step or something on the street corner crying. and then I published a note in our law review on flags of convenience, and this involved international law, labor law, and admiralty law. I found that very interesting. I've always been interested in areas of the law that combine a variety of different disciplines. And on the basis of that note, I was offered a job by the NLRB, to work in the General Counsel's Office of the NLRB, and I really wanted to take that job. But it was in Washington, and my husband was still working on his doctor's dissertation, so we weren't really free to move to Washington, so I was not able to accept that job. And I inquired about whether I could work for the NLRB in New York, and the man who ran the New York office said, "A woman? We're not hiring a woman in this office. She might have to interview Teamsters." So I thought, well, if the Wall Street firms won't hire me and the NLRB won't hire me, I will apply to the SEC because they had an honors program, and I was told this is one of the best of the government agencies, especially in New York, probably the best one in New York. And I did have this stint in working at a brokerage firm. So I thought, well, securities industry seems interesting. And so I applied, and I was hired because there was a decision had been made in the New York office to hire women. This was all before the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
This is in 62.
Right, right. And in fact, at some point, during my days at the SEC, I worked on a quickie criminal investigation with the man who was then the associate director, career employee, very good lawyer of his type. I remember during that investigation there was some terrified young man who came into the office, and this man had a big American flag waving in the office next to his desk, and he said to me, "Young man, are you going to be candid with your government or not?" And this poor guy just spilled his guts. Anyway, I worked on this investigation with him. We got an indictment in 3 weeks, which at that time was a record of some sort. And he said to me, "You know, you were hired over my objection, but you're working out all right." So the old-timers really didn't want women in the office.
What was the atmosphere like in the New York regional office? Talking a little bit about it with the old timers.
Well, first of all, this was during the Kennedy administration. The enforcement staff increased from 6 attorneys to 30, something like that. I may have the figures not exactly right, but approximately 6 enforcement attorneys to approximately 30. In a very short period of time. We were all the same age. We were all either just out of law school or, in the case of some of the men, just after their service, which they had gone into after law school, because in those days there was the draft. And so we were young and inexperienced, and we were playing cops and robbers. We were chasing the bad guys. This was pre-Watergate. There were very few constraints on government lawyers. Usually when we went to court, the judge would sign our injunctions without too much inquiry as to what we wanted. We were from the government. There was a presumption that we were entitled to whatever we were asking for. And We also tried a lot of administrative cases, and the attitude of the administrative law judges was that they were there to help the staff prove their case because the staff were a bunch of inexperienced lawyers who didn't know what they were doing. We had a lot of fun. I think that we had a lot more fun than young people do today.
Was it that whole Kennedy administration public service ethos that was?
Yes, partly. Partly it was that. People were not so ambitious in the way that a lot of young people are today. They were not so competitive. I was born in 1937, and so most of the attorneys in that office were in my cohort, either my age or a few years older. And we were a generation that was a small generation because not as many babies were born during the Depression. And we never worried about getting jobs. We were not so competitive with each other as young people are today. Even though I was a woman and I was worried about being discriminated against, and I was very determined to make the same amount of money as a man would make in whatever job I got, I never worried about getting a job, even as a lawyer, even though there was so much discrimination. There really was a labor shortage in terms of that age group.
Right.
So I think that's one of the reasons that we found work more enjoyable and less competitive.
Were there many women in the New York office?
There were some, not many. My first boss, Irene Duffy, was who became a judge, and her husband, Kevin Duffy, after I left the New York office, became the regional administrator. That's my first boss, so she was one of the women. There was an old-timer named Polly Antel. Were a few others, Faith Kolish, who still practices law, and is going to be at this meeting that I'm in Washington for, and Kathy Warwick, Judy Shepherd. I think that was about it. The women.
I guess you didn't feel
a handful. I wasn't the only one.
Yeah.
There were fewer in Washington, even though the staff in Washington was bigger.
Mm-hmm. How often did you get down to Washington?
Well,
I'm interested in what it was like coming to headquarters.
In the first couple of years, I don't think I ever went to Washington. But then I was in that office 6.5 years. Later on, I went to Washington with a certain amount of frequency. First of all, we went through a period in that office when we didn't have a regional administrator for about a year. Mm-hmm. During that period, I went to Washington more often. Also, I became a branch chief and then a assistant regional administrator in that office. So it seems to me I went to Washington more often then.
Did you ever sit in on a commission meeting?
The first commission meeting I ever went to, I presented a case to the commission at a regional administrators meeting in Washington. And I was kind of a show. The different regions presented cases on their own and not through the staff in Washington. And I presented a case that actually I worked on the entire time, virtually the entire time that I was on the commission staff. It was very complicated. Started out as contempt case against somebody who had been enjoined in a Section 5 violation for selling unregistered stock and had continued to sell the stock in this company. He was picked up in New Jersey at some point for carrying a concealed weapon and was sentenced to go to prison for this, in part because I went to the judge, or the, I think it was the judge, or someone else, with someone else from the New York office, and gave them information about what a bad guy we thought this fellow was. This was the kind of thing that now the Supreme Court has declared unconstitutional under the sentencing guidelines. But at the time, this was very routine. I think he owed some of the wrong people some money, and he didn't want to go to jail. And he was shot in what his family claimed was an accident, hunting jackrabbits in Oklahoma. He was from Oklahoma. So I had worked on this contempt proceeding for some time. I didn't really, this is how prosecutors operate. I didn't want to waste the results of my investigation because you don't get promoted by closing a case. Right. And so I developed a case against all of the broker-dealers that he had used in his manipulation of the market and sale of unregistered stock. And it was a rather complicated case based on market manipulation and violation of the margin rules, which are the rules that regulate how much credit brokers can extend to customers to buy securities. So we brought a case against a number of very reputable brokerage firms, and there was great resistance at that time to bringing this case. I remember being told by someone on the staff who was above me, "Oh, you can't bring this case, it's against member firms." And I said, "Member firms? Members of what? They're crooks, aren't they?" So anyway, this was the case I presented at the commission table at a regional ministers conference, and it was the first time I ever went to the commission's table. I have to tell you, I was very disappointed. I heard stories about going to the table when I was on the staff, as if this was almost a religious experience, or was like going to the Supreme Court. And the FCC then was in the old Quonset hut, buildings, temporary buildings put up during World War II. And so small, shabby room with a table that looked pretty much like a dining room table. And I sat at it and gave my presentation. This was a very big event in my early career, to be able to present a case to the commission directly.
Were the commissioners imposing?
The commissioners and all the regional administrators to me were older men who all looked alike. I've never been very good at recognizing faces, and I was the only woman in the room, I imagine. I don't have a clear recollection of this, but I think probably I was the only woman in the room. And just all these old men, that's how I saw them. Right. Yes, they were imposing in their way, but
well, let's move on to and what made brought the decision to go into private practice rather than stay with the SEC.
Stay with the SEC. Well, all my friends left the commission. Almost everybody except me had taken a job at the SEC to learn to be a lawyer, and until it was time to go out and get a real job, whatever that meant. I had no particular plans because it had been so hard for me to get any job after law school. And then I had three children while I was on the staff. But even though I had done very well in that office, and I was promoted to assistant regional administrator, which I think was probably the highest position any woman had ever had at the commission. I think that's right. It was a GS-15 in those days. Everything, probably today it's still true. It's whatever your GS right. number is. I didn't see much in the way of upside potential in that job. I was ambitious, and I began... My friends had all left, or the people that I started with had left. And I became kind of bored with all of these fraud cases. They all began to seem pretty much the same. So I started looking for a job at a law firm. In some ways, that was an even more frustrating experience than when I graduated from law school, because I had done so well at the commission, and yet it seemed that all the doors I was knocking on were closed. There was one firm that I interviewed at where a lawyer I had had been on the opposite side of a case, had tried to recruit me. It was a big firm, a Wall Street firm. And I was told afterwards, when they did not offer me a job, what the reason was that some of the partners had said, oh, she's very ambitious. She's going to want to be a partner. We're not ready for a woman partner yet in this firm. And I think that was probably true almost everywhere, because by then I was already... almost over 6 years out of law school. Seven, 8 years out of law school, people were being made partners. I did want to become a partner if I was going to go to a firm. So I looked for a job for an entire year, and then I was offered a job by two different Wall Street firms on the same day. And then I had to decide which one to take. And I've often wondered what would have happened to me if I had taken the other one. And I chose to go to Wilkie Farr & Gallagher to work primarily for a lawyer there named Kenneth Bjalken, who had a very large practice primarily representing broker-dealers. And although it was unusual for an associate to be hired to work primarily for one partner, I had a fair amount of expertise at that point with regard to regulation of broker-dealers, and he needed help. He wasn't the only partner at the firm I worked for, but during the years I was there, I did work primarily for Kenny and his broker-dealer clients. His most important client was a firm then called CBWL, which was Kogan Berlin, Weil & Lovett. Weil was Sandy Weil, the Lovett was Arthur Lovett, both of whom became very important in the securities field. That firm gobbled up a fair percentage of the firm's broker-dealer clients over the years. Two of the most interesting transactions that I worked on in those years were first the acquisition of an old-lying Wall Street firm, Hayden Stone and Company, by CBWL, and secondly, the public offering of CBWL the following year. The Hayden Stone acquisition was really extremely interesting. Hayden Stone was a very large firm, so large that CBWL had to go on to the books and records onto the computer system of Hayden Stone in order to do the acquisition. A very risky move, because one of the reasons Hayden Stone was in trouble had to do with books and records problems. I worked with someone else who was at CBWL in those days, who also became important in the securities industry. That was Frank Zarb. And Frank and I concocted the formula which made this work, which was that if any account that had short differences was discovered after the acquisition, CBWL Hayden Stone, as it then became, could return that account to the shell company, HS Equities, that was left behind when the Hayden Stone acquisition took place. In addition to that, the New York Stock Exchange actually financed this acquisition because CBWL didn't have enough capital for it to go forward. It was a fascinating matter to work on.
Why did you make the jump to Rogers and Wells?
Because I wasn't becoming a partner. I was passed over for partnership. And although I was assured by Kenny Bjorken that if I stayed, I would become a partner, the firm had no women partners. And I had decided that by the time I was 35 years old, I was going to be a partner in a law firm, or I was going to do something else. And don't ask me why I decided this, but I did. And that 35th birthday was coming up. I thought I had been out of school long enough to either become a partner in a law firm or move on. And when I was offered a partnership at Rogers & Wells, I took it.
Did you look for that partnership?
Well, I had a very close friend who had been one of the branch chiefs who worked for me, with me, when I was an assistant regional administrator, who had gone into the securities industry as a general counsel of a small brokerage firm. I should note that the vast majority of the lawyers in the New York regional office when I was there took jobs like that. It was the beginning of the legal compliance profession on Wall Street. And he had come to me at Wilkie Farr with a matter, but his firm was a client of Rogers and Wells. And he and I were close friends. We used to have lunch about once a week together, and our family socialized. And he knew I was very unhappy at Wilkie Farr with what was going on and being passed over for partnership. But it happened that Rogers and Wells and many other Wall Street firms at that time were being sued in a sex discrimination case by the New York State Equal Employment Commission, Eleanor Holmes Norton. And Rogers and Wells was at the top of the list because Bill Rogers was in the firm. This was really somewhat political, and Eleanor Holmes Norton thought that would help the case, I guess. And so Rogers and Wells was looking for a way out of its difficulties. And this friend of mine told Rogers and Wells that he wanted me to become a partnered there because he felt the firm needed someone to represent them, to do their work. And, in fact, that he had been considering taking the work elsewhere. And he had given me some work at Wookie Farm. So different circumstances led to my being made an offer to become a partner at Rogers and Wells. And after I got there, the first few years I was there, I spent about a third to half my time doing work for that particular brokerage firm. I mean, it was my major client in those days.
I think the cough's catching.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
It's probably very dry in here.
So in a way, you had some affirmative action going for you there.
Right, I did.
I
did.
Like that.
After years of discrimination, I was the beneficiary of some reverse discrimination.
Here's a big question. During those years that you were working for the law firms, how you're doing securities work, how did you see the industry changing?
When I was working at the SEC, and then when I was in private practice in the late 60s and early 70s, the industry was changing from an industry of small family partnerships to larger corporations. The industry was becoming a different kind of a business than it had been. Most of my clients at one time were partnerships. Those partnerships incorporated, and then some of them started to go public. At one time, it was contrary to New York Stock Exchange rules for a brokerage firm to be in any kind of business organizational form other than a partnership. It was considered unprofessional. Then it was against the stock exchange rules for a brokerage firm to be a public company. These barriers were actually broken down by first Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenrette, and then Merrill Lynch.
And this was before...
In addition to that, this is a question you're going to ask.
Yeah.
In addition to that, until the mid-70s, there were fixed minimum commission rates. And in 1975, commission rates were officially unfixed, but they began to be negotiated before then. And in fact, in the years when I was at Wilkie Farr, I spent a fair chunk of time on the phone with broker-dealer clients discussing with them whether or not certain rebative practices were lawful or not under the stock exchange rules. And these rebative practices were becoming more and more intense and came to cover more and more kinds of activities. And this was a part of the gradual unfixing of commission rates.
Mm. So they're starting to compete on
price. On price, yes. Firms were starting to compete on price. In addition, there was question as to whether investment companies had to form captive broker-dealers in order to lower the commission costs of mutual fund purchases. This was a big issue of the time. And this, too, was a sign that commission rates were starting were too high for institutional customers and were going to have to become one-sixth. Then, in addition, a phenomenon that accompanied this one-sixth and a half commission rates, but which also was related to the computerization of the back office and the paperwork crisis, is that in the early 70s, many, many brokerage firms went bankrupt. They failed, went bankrupt. And, in fact, so many went bankrupt that the New York Stock Exchange Trust Fund, which I believe was $69 million and seemed like a fortune at the time, was depleted. And in order to satisfy customer claims for brokerage firms which failed. Hmm. And starting when I was at Wilkie Farr and continuing when I was at Rogers and Wells, I worked on some very interesting broker-dealer bankruptcies.
Hmm. So all of this is feeding the creation of fewer larger firms.
Yes.
And the rates were unfixed in 75.
Yes, but began to be unfixed before that.
Officially. So it's shortly after that that you come into the commission, and I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about the nomination. When you heard about it and what you thought.
Right. In early 1977, and there was talk about a seat at the commission that had been vacant for a while. It had been unfilled, in part because the son of a New York congressman had been nominated for this post, and Senator Proxmire, who was then head of the Senate Banking Committee, held up any vote on this because he didn't feel a background as a politician or the son of a politician was appropriate for an SEC commission. I attended a meeting, I believe it was a meeting of the ABA, Federal Regulation of Securities Committee, the very same group that I'm in Washington for today. There was talk, gossip, chit-chat, that the Carter administration was looking for a woman for this position because there had never been a female SEC commissioner. There was also talk that the administration was looking for a New Yorker because there had not been a New Yorker on the commission since Bill Casey. And as we've discussed very briefly, the securities industry was in the throes of change. The 1975 Act amendments to the Exchange Act had been passed, which put into place the National Market System mandate, and it was obvious that the commission was going to take some actions that were going to have an extremely important effect on Wall Street. So, at this gathering, it may have been SEC Speaks, which happens every year, or it may have been an ABA meeting, I'm not too sure which. I said to some friends, in a very joking way, well, you know, you can tell the people in Washington that I'm available. And someone said, is that true? Are you serious? And I said, I guess so. It was kind of a joke as far as I was concerned at the beginning, because I couldn't imagine that I would be selected for a job like that. But then, some more conversations, people told me, you know, this is serious. If you're really interested, maybe we can put your name forward. I said, okay, I'll think about it. And then, I asked one of the Rogers and Wells was a very political firm. Most of the active, politically well-connected partners were Republicans, but there was one partner who was a well-connected Democrat. And I asked him, I said, you know, some people are putting my name forward to be an SEC commissioner. I said I was interested, but what do I have to do? I have no idea what I'm supposed to do to try and move this forward. So he said, well, you have to get a recommendation letter sent to the White House by someone who is in politics to get things started. I said, well, I don't know anybody like that. So I went home and thought about it. And at that time, the Westchester County executive, Al Del Bello, lived in Hastings. And a friend of mine worked for him. And I called her up and I said, some friends are suggesting that I try and become an SEC commissioner, but I need a recommendation from someone who is in politics to the White House. Do you think that Al Del Bello would write a letter for me? And she said, I'll ask him. So she asked him. You know, I don't know how much time you have. This is a bit of a long story, but it's actually very humorous if you want to hear it.
Sure.
So Al Del Bello lived in a house in Hastings, which is a converted barn, an old barn. If anyone who lives in that house has to give parties for worthwhile events, it seems to come with the house. So not too long after this, my husband and I were invited to a fundraising by Al Del Bello in that house. And I said to him, you know, we better go. I think maybe he's written a letter on my behalf to the White House about this SEC commissioner job. So we went, and there was a kind of receiving line, and we stood in line, and I was introduced to Al Del Bello. I said, hello, how are you? I'm Roberta Carmel. I want to really thank you for the letter that you wrote on my behalf. And he said, oh, yes, Governor Kerry is going to be calling you soon about the MTA. And I said, No. I said, I think you must have me mixed up with someone else. It's the SEC that I am trying to get to. I said, Governor Kerry will be calling you soon. This was, I think, in February, something like that. About 6 weeks later, I get a telephone call from a woman who identified herself as Judith Hope and said to me, please be available to go to a press conference on Friday because Governor Kerry is appointing you to the MTA. Friday, that Friday happened to be April 1st, 1977. I thought, this is some kind of April Fool's joke somebody's playing on me. Judith Hope, is that a real name? It is. Friday's April 1st, the MTA. I don't know anything about the MTA. And lo and behold, so I said, all right, give me the information, I'll go. And in fact, Governor Kerry had nominated me to be a member of the board of the MTA, and a day or two later, I have to check the the dates here, there was a front page story on the New York Times. And I have to check this, but I'm almost sure that this was Judy Miller's first front page story. Before this got set in stone, I really have to check that. Mm-hmm. Woman commuter appointed to MTA with my picture. My children have teased me about this ever since, and in fact, whenever someone takes a photograph of the family, they would say, "Mom, give them that old MTA smile." Because, although, to make a very long story a little bit shorter, I never was confirmed to be an MTA commissioner. I nevertheless served as if I were appointed for several months and went to a lot of events, so which all I had to do was smile. One of them I christened a train when the Brewster line became electrified. I went to a retirement dinner of 800 MTA motormen, and I smiled a lot. I was one of about 100 Cary appointees that were held up by the New York State Legislature, never confirmed. I did go to Albany for confirmation hearings, and some of the people in my firm who were very active Republicans said, you want this job? We'll get you confirmed. I said, no, I really, I'm trying to get to the SEC. But I was thinking, well, I suppose this is good practice if I do get nominated to the SEC and have to have confirmation hearings. All right. Then, right before the July 4th weekend, I got a telephone call that I should come to the White House for an interview, I thought, with Hamilton Jordan. That's what I thought was going on. No, wait a minute. I think I have skipped. First, I was called by Harold William, who was the chairman of the SEC, by his office, asking me to come to Washington for an interview with Harold Williams. And in fact, I remember the assistant said to me, and what kind of food would you like for dinner? And I said, what kind of food? I'm probably too excited when he decided. I don't care what kind of food. I was really taken aback by this a sort of treatment, and I remember at the time thinking, I am flying to Washington, D.C. for dinner and then coming back. I thought this is extremely exciting, real jet set life. And I met with Harold Williams, and we talked about a great many things. I can't say I really remember what they all were, but it was a job interview. I can't remember exactly when this was in the sequence between April 1st and July 4th, but I think it was sometime in May. And then I got this call to go to the White House. I also found out, this was a kind of lucky break, that one of the White House staff who was vetting the nominations for commissioner was an old law school friend of one of the Rogers and Wells partners. I think that was probably somewhat helpful in all of this. Also helpful, I think, was that Ken Bialkin, my old boss, I think campaigned quite a bit on my behalf for this position. Anyway, I get a call to come to Washington for an interview. At the time, I remember thinking, this process is all very interesting. You get called by people in Washington, come for an interview, come for dinner. Nobody says they're going to reimburse you for your expenses. You have to either have money or be, as I was, a partner in a law firm that was willing to finance this in order to qualify for these positions. I remember at the time thinking, this is it's not what I thought when I was a child about how democracy worked. The day I got to, I believe this was the Friday before the 4th of July weekend or something like that, the day before the 4th of July weekend, I got to Washington. It was a beastly hot, humid summer day in Washington. I remember going to the White House and feeling as if the streets were literally melting. It was so hot and uncomfortable, and also I was so nervous and excited. I felt like I was a child in some kind of a fairy tale, or I remember thinking, I don't know why I thought this, I feel like I'm Alice in Wonderland, this is so unreal. So I get to the White House. I think there was way less security than there is now, but, you know, I had to show them. I think I had to bring my passport, something like that. And I was admitted, and I was told that I was going to see the President of the United States. Well, I thought this, you know, I thought this was... I had not been expecting to be interviewed by the President. So, and the woman said to me, oh, don't be so nervous. He's a very nice man. So I go into the Oval Office and sit down, and I'm interviewed, and the President of the United States starts asking me questions. He had no notes, no notes at all, but had obviously memorized my entire resume, knew all about me, started asking me policy questions about SEC policy, particularly the SEC enforcement program, which at the time was considered by many to be overly aggressive. Was I going to be strong enough to do the job, he asked me. I said, yes, I thought so. He also said, when I was governor of Georgia, I got involved a little with the securities markets because we floated bonds. And I said, oh, I've been doing some bond work for the city of New York. We'll talk about that a little. After talking about the work of the SEC for a little bit, he said to me something that I think now would probably be illegal in an interview, or maybe was then, but he meant it very kindly. He said, oh, I see you have four children. Do you think you're going to have any more? Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't think so. I'm 40 years old almost. And it seems to me that's enough at my age. And he said, well, you know, Rosalind had Amy when she was about your age, and that was the best thing we ever did. Well, and we talked about the children a little bit. And I said, I'm talking to the President of the United States about my children. This is incredible. And then he said to me, do you have any reservations about taking this job? And I said, well, as you know, I have four children. And if I'm going to take this job, I have to move my family to Washington. And this has already dragged on for many months. And if I'm going to do that, I have to move them before September when school starts. So I'm really going to have to know one way or the other whether I have this job pretty soon. And when I think back upon it, I thought, what a nervy thing to have said in this interview, but that's what was on my mind, actually. And he said, well, I guess you have the job. I almost fainted. And he said, but don't tell anybody, it's a secret or something like that. You know, I said, well, can I tell my husband? You know, and he said, oh, yes, yes, that's right. The next morning, there was an article, I believe this time on the first page of the business section, with a Judy Miller byline saying Roberta Carmel first, you know, pointed to the SEC. How she got that story, I don't know. She must have had an interesting source back then, too. And then I did something which today I don't think anybody would ever do. I moved with my family to Washington before I was confirmed. Because it did not cross my mind at that point that I would not be confirmed.
Confirmations weren't as nasty.
Well, Proxmire confirmations could be very nasty. And in fact, people told me, you know, Senator Proxmire won't vote for you. He never votes for the SEC commissioners. I said, well, that's too bad. I would like to have his vote. In fact, I thought it would be really nice if both of the New York senators would introduce me at the confirmation hearings. And on the day we were moving from New York to Washington, Jack Wells of Rogers and Wells arranged a meeting between me and Senator Javits. And so I wasn't around the day of the move. My husband, I think, almost killed me. Mm-hmm. Well, I shouldn't say that for the record, but he was very angry. But that was very important to me. I mean, I knew that Senator Moynihan would introduce me, but I thought it would be nice if both of the New York senators introduced me. And I really had to pay this courtesy call on Senator Javits in order to accomplish that. And very happily, they did both come to the confirmation hearings. I have a very nice photograph in my office of the confirmation hearings, and I'm sitting at a table flanked by Senator Moynihan and Senator Javits. Also, I thought it would be nice if Senator Proxmire voted for me, contrary to his custom. And to go back to my family, my father was a lawyer in Chicago, and he was a partner in what was then the firm of Arvey, Hodes, and Mattenband. Jake Arvey was a big force in the Democratic Party in Chicago. Although my father was never political at all, and obviously from the story I'm telling you, I didn't know much about politics either. We both were in law firms with a lot of people who were very political. And Jake Arvey at that time was very sick. He was in the hospital. He died not too long after that. And my father had already died, but Jake Arvey called me up and said, oh, congratulations, it's wonderful that you're going to become an SEC commissioner. You know, is there anything I can do? I said, well, I am a little worried about Senator Proxmire's confirmation. And he said, oh, you don't have to worry about Senator Proxmire. I'm sure he'll vote for you. And whether he did anything or not, I have no idea. But Senator Proxmire was there when I was confirmed and said something like, it's about time we had a woman in this job, and was very cordial. And so the confirmation hearings were very easy. In fact, I went around and talked to all the different senators in order to be confirmed. And I was very excited and nervous and impressed by these different senators. And I remember thinking at the time, if I wasn't so nervous, this would be one of the great experiences of my life, getting to meet all these important people in Washington. And I had some very interesting conversations with the different senators. I remember talking to Senator Sparkman, who looked at my resume and said, so, young lady, you were born in 1937. That's the year I came to Washington. It's been a long time. You think I should stay? I said, well, what do you say to a question like that? So I said, well, are you still having a good time? Do you still enjoy your job? Then you should stay. And I have to say, the only senator who asked me serious questions about the SEC and securities law and securities policy was Senator Lugar, who then was on the banking committee. Although that, too, started out a little bit personal because I said, my sister lives in Indianapolis and my family used to have a business and my grandfather had a business in Indiana and the family still has it. So that was a little bit of chit-chat. But then he asked me, I can't remember what the questions were, but he asked me something. He took this seriously.
Yeah.
The others, it really was all just social calls.
You had talked to President Carter and Harold Williams, though, more than social calls.
Yes. Those were both job interviews. I remember talking to President Carter saying, the President of the United States is interviewing me for a job. Wow!
Did you come away from that with a sense of what the expectations were and that perhaps they matched your expectations of what you wanted to get done?
Yes, to both questions. Yes, to both questions.
And what were those expectations?
I think the expectations were that I should expectations were that perhaps the enforcement activities of the SEC were going out of bounds, and that if appropriate, I should rein in those activities. I mean, certainly nobody ever had the expectation, and I did not have the expectation, that the SEC should not continue to be an effective and vigorous enforcement agency. But there was a sense that the SEC was possibly abusing its powers in this area and possibly bringing cases that shouldn't be brought.
Mm-hmm. Did that dovetail with your own inclinations at the time?
Well, this was all the talk in New York among all the bar. Somewhat the way it is today, again, that the government is just going off the deep end, suing everybody for everything, and bringing really appearing a sort of reign of terror in terms of Wall Street and corporate America, and criminalizing activities that previously have not been thought to be even civil law violations. I mean, in this country we're not supposed to have common law crimes, and yet somehow we go through these populist periods when suing people in the business world or on Wall Street for activities that were not previously that were previously thought to be all right is a great heroic thing to do.
What was on the table?
I would say, and that the other topic that was on the table that was very important was how to implement the national market system. And at that time, there were people in Washington who seriously wanted to put the New York Stock Exchange out of business. And the Stock Exchange had not handled the transition from fixed to unfixed rates very well. They also had not handled the computerization of their back offices very well. And the Wall Street was really on the defensive. And again, neither Harold Williams nor the president had any particular instructions or message for me on this national market system, except that it was a matter of great importance to the country and the economy. and not something to be approached other than in the most serious possible way. And I think the fact that I was from New York, gave rise to the assumption that I would certainly be sensitive to the interests of Wall Street. At the same time, I'm originally from Chicago, and Chicago's also a financial city, and I certainly had no sense that I was any kind of a delegate from New York or anything like that.
Well, when you came and came to the commission and sat down, do you remember what some of the first agenda items were that you dealt with?
I don't remember what the exact agenda items were, but I remember at the very first meeting, I started questioning the staff, and I was not in favor of some enforcement recommendation, and this was considered rather heretical. And early on, we started trying to put together a policy statement on the national market system. In fact, there had been off-board hearings in Washington in the summer of 1977. And Harold Williams wanted me to come to those hearings, and I said, Harold, I can't come to those hearings. I'm moving my family, four children, to Washington, a household. I said, besides, I've heard enough about all this in New York. I think I understand what the issues are. I'll read some of the transcripts. And anyway, I think it's inappropriate. I haven't been confirmed yet. So I said, yeah, we started on that right away. It had really been going on before I even got there.
What could the SEC reasonably do to help bring this national market system about? What were the options available?
We could have abolished Rule 394. We could have abolished the off-board trading rules of the New York Stock Exchange so that trades in listed securities no longer had to be brought to the floor of the exchange if they were affected over the counter. And I think that most people expected we were going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Harold Williams didn't think that was a very good idea because it was too drastic a change. That if this was going to happen, it had to be done more gradually.
Mm-hmm.
He was also worried about internalization of order flow at broker-dealers and fragmentation of the markets. And the national market system provisions of the 75 Act are very schizophrenic in terms of mandating that on the one hand the national market system be based on principles of competition, on the other hand saying that it was supposed to be an integrated marketplace. Congress never made up its mind as to what this marketplace was supposed to look like, and the commission had a hard time implementing those provisions, besides which the statute said the commission was supposed to facilitate the implementation of a national market system. So we did something kind of in between. We abolished the off-board trading rules for agency orders, but not for other orders. This was not done until much later. Harold also pretty much forced the industry to come up with the intermarket trading system.
Was there a consensus on the commission about leaving 390 in place, or was there...
No. There was not.
Where did it come down?
Many of the decisions during the time I was a commissioner were that were not a consensus decision, five commissioners in favor or against, usually in favor. tended to break down into votes of 4-1, where I was with one, or 3-2, where it was the chairman, Phil Loomis, and me, and Irv Pollack and John Evans were on the other side. And I would say that was kind of the breakdown on the national market system, although these issues were so complicated. When the commission came out with its a national market system policy statement, there were I don't believe there were dissents. I think it was a commission statement, and the rules were a commission statement, but there was a fair amount of give and take on that. Different perspectives. But I would say those were issues where the chairman and I were pretty much on the same wavelength.
So you wanted to see 390 stay in as well?
At that time, yes. At that time, yes. I thought it would be too abrupt a change to impose on Wall Street. And, moreover, it was not for the government to do that. I just didn't think it was... I remember having a rather strange conversation one day with the head of the enforcement division at the SEC, Stanley Sporkin, said, "Roberta, I don't know what we're going to do about this national market system." He said, I think we should have some sort of government agency like CompSat that should build the national market system. I said, "Stanley," and then went and shoot it into space. This has to come from the industry. The government can't dictate what the market should be. The government, even if that was good policy, which I don't think it is, the government couldn't do it. They would build the national market system and nobody would come to it.
Right.
So I think there was a little bit of a difference between the Washington insider's view of what the government was capable of doing, really, and having anybody pay attention and follow the rules, and those of us who came from outside the Beltway. And I really felt that changes in the structure of the markets couldn't be top-down command and control regulations, that they had to come from the industry, although the SEC had so much plenary control over the exchanges and broker-dealers that they could certainly influence the outcome a great deal, but they couldn't, the SEC could not build a national market system or even construct the building blocks for a national market system, and I didn't think that was the appropriate role of government anyway. Mm-hmm. If the New York Stock Exchange or any other market was going to go out of business because it was not keeping up with the demands of the economy and the times, it wasn't for the government to save that marketplace either.
Right.
But it wasn't for the government to decide to put our primary market out of business.
Right. Well, you...
I don't know that would have happened if Rule 390 had been removed either.
Right.
You know, I mean, conversation like this, you necessarily say things that are overly simplistic.
Sure.
These issues are very complicated.
Sure. Well, you brought up Stanley Sporkin and enforcement. And clearly, even by the time you got there, I think he was already legendary in some respects.
He still is.
Even more now. So you must have been prepared to come in and deal with this very energetic enforcement division. Was it what you expected, and what was it like?
Yes and no. Remember, I had been part of the enforcement division when I was on the staff. And in fact, Stanley had been responsible for had been one of the people who recommended that I be promoted from branch chief to assistant regional administrator in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So he had been one of my supporters when I was on the staff, and I think the enforcement staff expected me to come in and dream up creative new cases for them. That's what I had done when I was on the staff. And they also found it very difficult, since I was a woman and since I had been a lower down in the bureaucracy than they were when I was on the staff, to look to me as someone that they had to be accountable to, that they had to please me, that I had now become one of the bosses, if you will. And I really didn't go to the SEC thinking I was going to get into a big battle with the enforcement staff. I thought the commission my feeling was the commission is losing its way a bit in the courts. They've lost some cases. They're going to lose some more cases. They're going to lose credibility. The agency has to be more careful in the kind of cases it brings, less aggressive in bringing novel cases, because the courts and public opinion have changed. And I should have expected the kind of resistance that my ideas were met with, but to be honest, I didn't. Or at least didn't expect for my efforts to change commission policy to be so difficult.
Hmm. How about the other commissioners?
Well, I mean, Irv Pollack had been head of trading and markets, which was the predecessor to the enforcement division. And Stanley Sporkin was his protege. And he, I think quite understandably, as a matter of policy, favored most of the enforcement division's recommendations. Phil Loomis was prior general counsel, so he also was an insider. And John Evans had been on the Senate Banking Commission. So I was on the commission with three career government employees who I think saw their roles and viewed commission policy as helping the staff to bring their cases. Mm. I saw things a little differently. Also, Phil Loomis and Irv Pollack had been with the commission during the Watergate years and the post-Watergate years, where the White House really did try and improperly influence some commission enforcement cases, and so the kind of bonding that had gone on during that period in resisting White House efforts to interfere with commission enforcement policies that carried through. While my attitude was, this period's over. We have to go on to a different construct here. I was much younger than the other commissioners, too. So I think it was harder for them to give me deference in terms of what my views were. Mm-hmm. And my views were contrary to the way in which they had thought for many years. Who was this newcomer coming in and trying to change commission policy?
Were you aware of the shift, still sort of gradual at this time, but the shift toward the right in American political culture?
Yes.
With deregulation?
Yes. And in the courts. There had been some Supreme Court cases that I thought were very important that I kept citing in the commission meetings. And
such as?
Green against Santa Fe. Mm. I thought was extremely important case at the time. There were some other cases, but I remember that one. I thought it was a very important case. I kept bringing it up at commission meetings, and people thought, it's just the Supreme Court. It was sort of sad. That's just one case. I felt that if the Carter administration as a whole and the commission did not come up with some new policies that were responsive to not shifting political winds, that the next administration would not be a Democratic administration. Mm-hmm. And indeed, that's what happened.
Yeah.
I think the failure of the Carter administration generally, and the SEC was just a tiny part of that administration, but the same things were going on everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think the failure of that administration to come up with the kind of policies that were responsive to the changing political mood paved the way for the Reagan landslide. I mean, everybody was still in this, post-Watergate mood that had prevailed in Washington for a while.
Yeah, and there's still something of the Great Society, big government
initiatives
as well.
That the government could solve all the problems. You know, I think this was the national market system conceit. The government can solve these problems of Wall Street.
Right. You settled into a pattern, so to speak, and I know that this is an oversimplification because there were many decisions made, but some of the notable ones, you actually issued dissents.
I started dissenting. Actually, the first dissent was on a rulemaking proceeding that had to do with an initiative to define independent directors of public companies. I felt that the SEC did not have the authority under the statute to decide what kind of directors were independent and should serve on the boards of public companies.
Mm-hmm.
This was a Green against Santa Fe issue, as far as I was concerned. Okay. So that was my first dissent, and I was sorry about it, because this actually was a pet project of the chairman, of Harold Williams. And this was one of the areas where Harold and I did not agree. And I didn't really want to have to dissent in this rulemaking procedure. And I tried to persuade the staff to change the wording of the release in a way that I could agree to it. But in the end, they wouldn't do that, and I wouldn't give in either. I said, I am going to dissent from this particular part of the rulemaking proposal, and I was told, you can't do that, there's no procedure for doing that. I said, look, at the end of every commission order, it says, by the commission, I'm part of the commission, and I don't agree to this. And I don't care if nobody ever dissents from commission orders or not. I'm going to do this in some fashion. So what we did, it was a very modest technique. We dropped a footnote from that part of the rulemaking proposal with which I did not agree. It was a small part, actually, but it was something that was important to me. And it just said, Commissioner Carmel dissents from, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but it was like a sentence or two. Dissents from this part of the reason. Well, I was completely unprepared for the consequences of the knife. Because all of a sudden, I was kind of taken up by the Main Street business interests. Because that's who this affected. This was not a Wall Street issue. This was a Main Street issue. This had to do with the board of directors of big public companies. And I was saying, although it's just a little footnote, I was saying, I think that public companies, I don't think the FCC can tell public companies who should be put on their boards. Mm-hmm. That was essentially what I was saying, although I say it was a very low-key, subtle, I thought subtle.
This was part of a broader corporate governance
push. Yes, it was part of a very broad corporate governance push. I just didn't think the commission, even if this were correct policy, and I had some doubts about whether it was correct policy, but even if this were correct policy, I just didn't think the SEC had the authority to do this. I thought this was a state law issue, and I really didn't think, I thought the government should not be constructing the composition of corporate boards. In Sarbanes-Oxley, the commission got this power that I thought it didn't have in 1977, although very indirectly. I mean, it didn't even in Sarbanes-Oxley, Congress gave this power to the commission very indirectly by saying the commission could compel the stock exchanges and the NASD to do this in their listing rules. Anyway, I all of a sudden started getting invitations to speak at certain kinds of functions and became well known in the corporate America world as someone who was, I wouldn't say on their side exactly, but who was at least listening. That's what people would say to me a lot when I was a commissioner. You're a breath of fresh air, you listen to people in the business world. I thought that was my job.
Some other notable... That's okay. Some other notable things, and something that came up earlier was the Spartec case. Can you tell me about 21A?
Well, the Spartec case was my next famous dissent, and this was an enforcement case, and this was the first enforcement case that I dissented in. It was what was called, what was then called the going private phenomenon. It was part of a going private transaction. In my opinion, the commission did not have the, again, did not really have the authority to say that what had gone on in that case was illegal. And maybe the commission thought so too, because they settled this case with a 21A report, which set forth the results of a commission investigation and said, essentially, we think this was wrong, and the company has agreed to certain remedial action or that they won't do it again. And just published that as the result of an investigation. I believe that publishing a 21A report was a sanction. There were ferocious arguments between the staff and me on this case. And the staff insisted they were going to bring it, and I said I wouldn't go along with it. And they said, well, you can't dissent because it's a settlement. I said, well, a judge can say we don't have the jurisdiction to accept the settlement, and that's what I'm going to say. This was, again, oversimplifying.
Sure.
This was the dialogue. It hardly was a dialogue. It was a screaming match. In fact, I remember one of the lawyers who was essentially my counsel. We had a different, I think he was then called legal assistant. We had a different name for it. Person who was like my counsel said to me, "You know, Roberta, you're really one of them," meaning the enforcement staff. "When you're in an argument with them, it's you're one of them." I said, "Well, yes, of course I'm one of them. That's where I came from. I was an enforcement attorney too. I mean, it became a great adversarial contest."
Yeah.
And I ended up dissenting. A little footnote to that, actually, is the staff attorney, I have to go back. One of the changes I made in the way in which the office of a commissioner functioned is that at the time I became a commissioner, every commissioner was entitled to one lawyer and a confidential assistant. I felt one lawyer wasn't enough, that I had too much I wanted to accomplish, there was too much work to do, that I really needed more than one lawyer. But there was no budget line for a second lawyer. I think now commissioners have three.
Mm.
So I taught, and John Evans and Earth Pollock and Phil Loomis felt one was more than enough for them. So nobody else had this demand. So Harold and I came up with a idea. Let me borrow a lawyer from the different divisions for a short period of time, 6 weeks, 2 months, 3 months, and they'll just rotate through my office. It won't have to be a new budget line for the Office of Commissioners, because I'm just borrowing them from the divisions, and they could work for me for a short time, and this would be good, because then they would go back to the division they came from. And I thought to myself, and I'll have a friend in every division who can tell me what's going on and try and promote my views. So this was, I'd say, a great idea, and Harold went along with it. Well, after the Spartak case, after this all became public, I found out that the attorney in enforcement whose case this was a woman whose father was the ambassador to Iran, and at that time, the revolution was going on. The Shah was deposed. She was really worried about her family and quite distracted from the Spartak case, which and I felt so terrible about this afterwards. I thought, oh, this poor woman, you know, she's worried about really important family matters and big events in the world, and we're just squabbling about this SEC enforcement case. I chose her to be the next person to come and work for me in my office as one of my lawyers. And we actually became good friends. We're still good friends.
Who was that?
Ann Sullivan. She's still at the commission, actually. Became the basis for a very long friendship. I felt so guilty that I had caused her even more stress at a time of a really terrible personal crisis that she was going through.
Well, moving to another important topic, I talked to Ted Zondi a while back, who was in enforcement.
Right.
Working, and he talked a lot about gatekeepers.
Right.
And I guess this has something to do with the 2E
right.
cases. Can you
everything to do with the 2E cases. All right. I have never believed that lawyers should be gatekeepers. Or that the SEC should have the power to compel lawyers to rat on their clients. To find a point on what everybody's talking about all the time. I think this is contrary to the role of lawyers, whether they are acting as defense counsel in enforcement cases or as transactional lawyers. I think the job of a lawyer is to represent his or her client zealously. And if a lawyer believes that SEC policy is misguided, or if the client believes it's misguided, I think a lawyer has the obligation and the right to try and challenge the SEC's interpretation of things. This doesn't mean that a lawyer can counsel a client to violate the law. There's a difference between challenging the government and counseling the violations of the law. I don't think lawyers should be put in a position where they are agents for the government. And I have to say, I feel this as strongly today as I felt it back in the late 70s. And I am very alarmed at some of the policies that are being put into place today in the name of fighting terrorism or prosecuting people in the business world that are driving this country into becoming a kind of police state. I think we are really losing our ability to challenge government policies. Mm. That may be wrong. I have never understood, well, this is too much of an aside, but I've never understood why people who can see that when it comes to issues involving the criminal law or national security, don't see that when you talk about some of the excesses in the regulation of the business world, that isn't the same exact dynamic. To me, it's always been the same. Yeah. Due process is due process. The ability to challenge government prosecutors is the ability to challenge government prosecutors. And I think that if lawyers are made into gatekeepers, they lose this ability to challenge the government. Now, if a lawyer is not acting as a lawyer, if a lawyer is acting as a principal, then that lawyer should have no protection against being prosecuted like anybody else if the lawyer violates the law. There have unfortunately been many, many lawyers who have been defendants in insider trading cases. I've never understood why lawyers who have very good jobs, very good law firms, are so foolish as to risk their entire career and professional life by engaging in insider trading. It's crazy. And there have been many lawyers, especially in the 80s, who were defendants in insider trading cases. I would never say the SEC shouldn't prosecute these people. But I think to compel a lawyer who is acting not as principal in a transaction, but only as a lawyer, to be a gatekeeper, to be an agent of the SEC, is wrong. I think if assistant U.S. attorneys started doing this, saying lawyers have to go before the grand jury and testify to the crimes that clients have committed, people would see there's something wrong with this.
Right.
But to me, what the SEC has always advocated is really the same thing. The SEC is a prosecutorial agency.
Was the rationale given that this was a way of increasing the agency's leverage?
Yes. Yes. I mean, the rationale is that lawyers and other gatekeepers should be responsible for their clients' behavior, and then there'll be more compliance with the law.
Right. You mentioned insider trading briefly. Was this...
I don't know if that is enough of this 2E. I mean, when I was at the commission, I was on a very different... I had very different views about Rule 2E cases than the rest of the commission and the staff then had. And we had many debates about this at commission meetings.
Was there a notable case in which this came up?
Came up in every 2E case. I didn't think at that time that the commission had the authority to bring 2E cases against lawyers. In addition, I felt that many of the cases involved matters that were not violations of the law, and many of them were settlements. So some of these dissents were like my 21A dissents. The question was, well, if it's a settlement, how can you... I would be challenged. If it's a settlement, how can you dissent from settlement? I said, well, if the commission has no jurisdiction, I can dissent from accepting the settlement. We did have one policy meeting on 2E. I mean, there was so much contention about this. We had one policy meeting on 2E that must have lasted about 6 hours, in which we debated all of this. The room was, the commission room, was filled with staff. It was like a show. I mean, every seat was taken. And I remember thinking, if all of these people were billing their client by the hour, this would be unconscionable. But, so we really debated this in a commission meeting on that subject. Rather than with regard to any particular case, although the debates continued on the particular cases, but it was, a general meeting on commission policies as regard to Rule 2E. Actually, the case where some of this came out was the Carter Johnson case, but that wasn't decided until I left. Mm-hmm. There was no commission decision until I left. I think that everyone might have delayed that till after I left. I'm not sure. And then Ed Green, when he was general counsel, gave a speech at the County Lawyers Association, basically adopting the view that I had articulated on my dissents. And this pretty much was commission policy for the next 25 years until Sarbanes-Oxley, and of course now these debates have broken out all over again.
Mm. Well, that gets to the issue of what you were looking to accomplish with the dissent.
I was trying to change commission policy.
Was it a sense that other people would study these dissents and it would make a difference years from now? Or
yes. Yes. I was trying to change commission policy.
But you realized you weren't going to change that commission's mind at that point.
Well, I was hoping that there might be a change in the composition of the commission while I was a commissioner, and then there would actually be a change.
Mm-hmm.
But when John Evans was reappointed, it was apparent that I realized there was not going to be any change in the composition of the commission, and that whatever configuration there was on various issues was going to pretty much remain what it was. I wasn't really involved in any of those decisions, but the decision as to whether or not he was going to be reappointed dragged on for some time.
Carter administration didn't know whether it wanted to?
I really wasn't a party to these decisions. All I can say is it dragged on for a long time. It was very unclear whether he was going to be reappointed or not. There was obviously disagreement in various quarters about this. And when he... I mean, John Evans was a very nice man. I really don't want to say anything negative about him. He was a nice man. He was respectful of me. I always tried to be respectful of him. He had a very... He was very sincere in what he believed in, just as I was sincere in what I believed in. We didn't agree on a lot of issues. He died in the last few years.
But you would have been. You would have
but if a different... I was watching the political cards, and I think that if that seat on the commission had become vacant and had been filled by someone whose views were closer to mine, then my dissents might have become the majority view in terms of that commission's policy. And after I left the commission on some issues, such as 2E, my policies did become the commission's policy. I said particular. But then Sarbanes-Oxley, we're back to where we were. So it makes me think of the futility of trying to stop the accretion of governmental power. It's like the child story of the little kid with his finger in the dike. I mean, the government just keeps getting more and more and more powerful and passing more and more and more regulation, and old regulations never are repealed.
Yeah, right.
I think it's a serious problem of our government and our country.
Something that we haven't talked about very much, although you mentioned it, was insider trading.
I don't know if you... You said you wanted some of the more human parts of this. I should say, Ed Green was someone who was at Wilkie Ferdinand Gallagher. I recruited him to the commission to become head of Corp Fin, although he didn't come in to head up Corp Fin. But that's why he was recruited in, to become the next head of Corp Fin, and then he became general counsel. And so he came from a very similar background to mine, and at some point, while I was still a commissioner, we were sent on a mission to Japan. We went on together. Spent about 10 days in Japan talking to Japanese businessmen and government officials about foreign issuer disclosure. The Japanese were quite exercised at that time because the SEC had actually brought down a Japanese government because of the Lockheed scandals. And the Japanese thought the SEC was an extremely powerful government agency. Busloads of Japanese tourists used to get off in front of the sign that said SEC and have their picture taken. But all of this is to say that it's not surprising that Ed and I had similar views on an issue like Rule 2E. I mean, we had similar backgrounds in some ways, and we were business friends. And we had the opportunity to talk to each other quite a bit about commission policy.
And was he responsible for making the changes in Rule 2E?
Yes. He also was responsible for, that was when he became general counsel, which was really after I had left. But and then while I was a commissioner, he was responsible for putting into place the building blocks for the integrated disclosure system, which I very much favored, and which I thought was an extremely important commission policy. And again, although it seems quite integral to the commission's disclosure policies today, it was very controversial at the time. Some members of the commission didn't favor it. They thought that it was eliminating too much of 33 Act disclosure documentation.
Making it too easy to register.
Yes. Well, too easy to register. Some of the commission just didn't believe this abbreviated registration was a good idea. And in fact, I stayed at the commission a few weeks longer than I otherwise might have to be able to vote in favor of the first integrated disclosure initiative.
Were you a necessary part of the majority for that one?
Probably. Although it was not, there were no dissents. I mean, the commission often will reach a consensus, even if you dug down underneath that consensus, there were disagreements.
Right. It would depend on what the stakes were, I'm sure.
Depending on what the stakes were, it would depend on what the majority was. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of times, if there was a majority in favor of a particular action, it's not really worthwhile to dissent. In addition to that, until I started dissenting, this wasn't done. And so, the other commissioners really never, I can't remember any time when the other commissioners dissented from a majority decision. It was considered bad for him to dissent. But
I did want.
I'm sorry, I got you off on to disclosure policy, but that's an important part of the commission.
Right, integrated disclosure.
Yes.
Yeah. And of course, it would become extremely important in the 80s, but I wondered if there was some movement on the commission in regard to insider trading at this point, if that was being seen as a problem.
Yes, it was seen as a problem, and it was also, that's the cleanest, I'm sure. There were problems with insider trading, and there were also debates about this, because the SEC lost the Key Relic case in the Supreme Court, and there's kind of two matters I can recall when I was a commissioner. One was the commission passed an anti-fraud rule under Section 14. That said, in effect, you in insider trading cases in the tender offer context, we don't have to prove scienter or breach of fiduciary duty. To this day, it's not clear if the commission had the authority to pass that rule. It came up in the O'Hagan case a few years ago. But since the Supreme Court in that case decided there was insider trading in violation of Rule 10b-5, it said, a fortiori, there's violation of the anti-fraud rule under Section 14. I was at the commission when that rulemaking got started. I'm not sure if I was there when the final rule was passed. I'd have to check that. And I had no problem with that. I often felt if the SEC would pass a rule outlawing some behavior and go through the notice and comment process, that rule can be justified under the statute. Mm-hmm. That's an appropriate way to go forward. What I often objected to was trying to get there through enforcement cases, trying to define new violations through enforcement cases. I wrote a book called Regulation by Prosecution. I don't think this is an appropriate way for the government to make new law.
So you bring a case through enforcement.
Yes.
Something that's not necessarily illegal or against the administrative rules.
Had previously not been thought to be illegal.
How does it suddenly become illegal?
Because if the SEC brings a number of cases and this isn't rejected by the courts, it becomes the new standard. And often, because in civil cases, there are so many consents and settlements. In criminal cases, there are so many plea bargains. The person the SEC is calling to account doesn't really challenge the new interpretation. This is why I didn't feel it was inappropriate dissent in a settlement, because a settlement is between somebody under investigation who wants to settle the case and the SEC enforcement staff. And settlements shouldn't become new law. But they do, if there are enough of them, particularly.
And so that's what happened in the Chiarella case, right? The court decided that these earlier rationales for insider trading wouldn't work.
Yes. The other effect of Chiarella was it called into question some of the cases the commission was prosecuting. Mm-hmm. One of them being SEC against Dirks, which was an administrative proceeding. I believe that was one of the cases where, can I have to check the dates? I think that was one of the cases where when when the staff tried to write a commission opinion, when the case was appealed from an administrative law judge to the commission, they couldn't come up with an opinion that I would go along with. And this opinion did not come out until after I had left. And then the Supreme Court reversed. So they should have listened to me.
I suppose you were happy to see that.
Well, yeah. In a way. I mean, I never like to see the commission.
Right.
reprimanded by the Supreme Court, and that's what I was always trying to prevent when I was a commissioner.
Well, I think you talked a little bit about your reasons for stepping down. You still had some time to go, I guess.
Yes.
Was it simply this sense that the makeup of the commission wasn't
changed? No. That's not why I stepped down. President Carter wanted everybody to take a 5-year pledge when he appointed people. Mm-hmm. And my husband was not willing to move to Washington for more than 2 years. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, if you promise more than 2 years, we're not going to go. So I actually wrote a letter to the White House saying I could only promise to stay for 2 years mm-hmm. for family reasons. And after 2 years, my husband and children moved back to New York, and I was actually commuting for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And that was, it was very expensive. I really didn't have the money for that kind of a lifestyle. And it was also very difficult. I had young children. It wasn't working out very well. So I really left for personal reasons, okay. Family reasons.
Really for personal reasons?
Yes. It was really for family reasons. I mean, my daughter was only in third grade. Her teacher told her, I'm sorry, your parents are getting divorced. I didn't learn this until years afterwards, but she would be very tearful every Sunday night or Monday morning when I would go back to Washington. I only found out years later that she thought this meant that my husband and I were getting divorced. But, you know, she was very upset, and the boys were not so happy with it either.
Sure.
My husband wasn't so happy with it. It wasn't a good arrangement. I don't think commuting marriages are a very good idea.
Right. Well, you went back to Rogers and Wells, I guess.
Yes. That, too, was... I remember Harold Williams said, well, you should just make an announcement that you're leaving and see what happens. And I said, I remember thinking and saying, well, I don't know that it's appropriate for an SEC commissioner to do that. To me, that was like kind of sale of public office almost. Not really. That goes too strong. I wasn't comfortable with doing that. Although it's very, very common today, not only for commissioners, but for high staff members. I always really planned on going back to Rogers and Wells, and that's what I told the White House when I took the job. That was my plan. So I never tried to look for any other job at the time.
How did you?
In retrospect, I think that was a mistake. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure you can ever go back. I remember people asked me when I got back there, what's it like? I said, I don't know. It's like coming home from college.
Right.
They think I'm the same person, and I'm not.
Well, that's my question. How did your experience affect the way you looked at securities law for the rest of your career?
It definitely changed my life and my outlook. But I think the main way in which it changed my life is that I moved into a different league in terms of the doors that were open to me and my own perspective on securities law.
Can you say a little more about that perspective, how it changed?
Well, I saw the bigger picture. I had a much better understanding of how the commission operated and how policy decisions were made. And I had learned about a lot of areas of securities law that I previously had not been involved in very much.
And
Also, many opportunities. Many doors were open to me that had not been opened before.
Like being a director of the New York Stock Exchange.
Like being a director of the New York Stock Exchange. Even that came about in a kind of quirky way. John Phelan was at the New York Stock Exchange when I was a commissioner, but I don't remember what his position was. He wasn't president yet, or certainly not chairman. He came to Washington to talk to the commissioners about national market system with Neil Batten, and would kind of come around and talk about policy, and I was quite impressed with him. I thought he was a very impressive intellect. And after I got back to New York, he was made president of the Stock Exchange, and I did something that was somewhat uncharacteristic, but in a way this is what I meant by saying I was in a new league. I either wrote him a letter or called him up and congratulated him on becoming president and said, let me take you to lunch. This is something I never would have done before I had been in commission. And we had lunch and talked and kind of became friendly. And I think it was that lunch. And the fact then that Sandy Weill was head of the nominating committee that year for the exchange, that really gave me, opened up the opportunity for me to go into the Stock Exchange Board.
How useful was your SEC experience on the board?
Very. Very. I mean, that was a job I came into knowing virtually all the issues from the first day. I was a public member. As opposed to a securities industry member, many of the other public members were CEOs or retired CEOs of public companies. And while they were very smart and powerful men, no women, they really didn't know very much about how the securities markets worked or about the New York Stock Exchange or about the issues. I remember the secretary of the exchange told me one year that I was on the board, Roberta, you have gone to more meetings of committees and more committee meetings than any public member. I said, that's because you put me on virtually every committee because I know what's going on. I said, in addition, I'm a lawyer, and this is a regulatory agency. I said, you really need some more lawyers on this board, even though businessmen don't like lawyers very much to be on boards of directors.
Well, just to sort of wrap up, you talked about doors opening. And in some respects, it seems unusual or backwards for someone who was once in this big regulatory agency to go and become a college professor. Often it works the other way around. What did that mean to the way you teach your classes, the way you deal with students?
I should say I always wanted to be a law school professor, but this was a field that when I was young, and even further along in my career, and even today, was much more close to women than other parts of the legal profession. I mean, I would say business opened up first, and then, no, government opened up first, and then business, and then the white shoe law firms, and then teaching. For a long time after I became a full-time professor, I still was a partner in a law firm. And even today, I still do some consulting. Mm-hmm. So I've never totally left off being a securities lawyer as well as being a professor. But I feel that as a professor, I've been able to bring all of my experiences to bear on my teaching. It's given me a real perspective. I also should say, I did teach as an adjunct at Brooklyn Law School for 4 years before I became a commissioner. And people often ask me, well, what was the best preparation you had for being a commissioner? And I say, actually, teaching. Because it gave me the ability to get up on my feet in front of a group of people and speak and articulate an idea. And I found that very useful to my job as a commissioner.
Well, at this point, I should ask if there's anything we've left out.
Oh, I think you've left out a lot. I've had a long life, and this is a long conversation, and I don't, you know.
You've certainly done well articulating your ideas this morning, so I want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's kind of fun. It's a very self-indulgent experience to talk about my life like this.